to the latest edition of the By The Men MFC podcast. Tonight we're absolutely delighted to welcome Motherwell FC General Manager Alan Burrows. Alan, welcome. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, it's good to be here. I know I promised you a couple of weeks ago that I would do this, and you know, a lot's happened in that time, so I'm sure there's plenty to talk about.
Yeah, and also a fond welcome, as always, to Jay and Buster, who are our stalwarts and here for the 15th week running, so we're surviving, guys, eh?
Aye, not bad, not bad. I'm getting there with my man flu, but aye.
How you doing, Buster?
Aye, there's nothing up with me, I'm fine. I'm sure this week, so...
I have to say, Andy, have you said to me 10 years ago that you'd be sitting here as a general manager of Motherwell Football Club doing a podcast with Jay and Buster? I think we're not. So life can take funny turns.
That's it. Well, Alan, I'd imagine that it's been a very busy few weeks for yourself, and would it be fair to say that it's been the most positive time in your tenure as general manager at Motherwell Football Club, given, I don't know if it's me being assumptuous, but it got off to a wee bit of a rocky start, possibly due to the results on the park?
Yeah, probably has been the most positive, certainly in the last couple of weeks. I think, from my point of view, when I first took over, or first replaced Leanne back in June, I think at that point we'd managed to secure a number of the squad down on longer-term contracts. I think we'd managed to get our business done relatively early. And I think at that point everybody was looking forward to the season. You know, we'd obviously finished best in the rest of the third year in a row, and you know, all the indications were that the squad was staying intact and there wasn't going to be too much of an upheaval for the first time in a number of years. So, you know, certainly at that point, everything positive, you know, pointed to a positive season ahead. We obviously had Europe to look forward to as well. We got what we thought was a favourable draw, I suppose, in Stjarnan from Iceland. Obviously, at that point, still on the domestic cup. So, you know, we go back to kind of the early June, start of July period, I think there was still, from my point of view, a lot of optimism about what lay ahead. And obviously, you know, subsequently, things haven't quite worked out on the pitch. I think that's fair to say. And when things don't work out in the pitch, that percolates across the football club. You know, we're a Motherwell football club, and I suppose as the name suggests, so first and foremost for us is to win football matches. I mean, that's not happening. You know, and my firm belief is that everybody at the football club's got to be looking at what they're doing and questioning themselves, and can they do better? And that very much includes me. So, pardon me, the last couple of weeks, obviously, with a couple of new players coming in, a bit more fighting spirit at Tannadice, albeit a defeat, a good point against St Johnstone after, you know, going down to 10 men and, you know, probably would have crumbled weeks before that. So, yeah, there's a lot of good things, and then obviously culminating in the deadline day signings and things, there's a lot more to be a bit chirpy about, but I suppose, again, the proof of the pudding is going to be needed. We need to win games, we need to win games quickly. So that's what's the main focus now, is to try and make sure that Ian and the team have got the best possible chance to try and win games and get us up the table.
Tell us a wee bit about deadline day, because it was a deadline day, it's fair to say, like no other at Motherwell Football Club, where right up until that 12 o'clock deadline, there seemed to be activity. Yourself, you were quite active in Twitter, and they're saying there might be one more to come, and it was really, really exciting. That must have been quite remarkable, given that in previous years we've been quite used to doing our business early, and the doors would be shut at 6, 7 o'clock, knowing that there wouldn't be any activity in the way, and then, thankfully, as well, not losing any players as well.
No, you're right. I remember I was laughing, I was joking me and Barraclough on the night, and I was telling them that during the last the summer transfer window, somebody tweeted to the Motherwell account. It was something along the lines of "Welcome to transfer deadline day," or as we Motherwell fans know it as Monday, which I thought was quite funny. Given that most of the stuff that we do isn't really has been done long before that, as you say. And deadline days, you know, I've spent most of my time when I was my previous role head of comms, watching Jim White and the guys on Sky Sports News around about 11 o'clock not doing any business. This one is completely different to that, as you said. And a lot of that was through necessity. We've got, you know, 10, 11 players out, or have had 10, 11 players out injured. And then, you know, I think it was pretty clear from all we see, including yourselves and the guys who have been analysing things over the last 10, 15 weeks, that we probably needed fresh faces and fresh bodies. And, you know, that Ian Barraclough was well aware of that. he had a number of people in mind, most of whom we got, one or two that we didn't. But I think all in all, I think it was pretty fair, safe to say that Ian, had his targets in mind. We got a hold of most of them. We missed out on one or two, which is just par for the course, I suppose. But it was an interesting day, and from excitement of having the four or five players who we thought we were going to get, almost within an hour, we thought we were going to get none of them. Such was like a to and fro between other clubs and who we were trying to get, and then all of a sudden, as we transpired, we managed to get the four guys who we were after and missed out on one on deadline day. So, it was a mixture of emotions, excitement, depression, deflation, relief. Particularly as it was getting towards 12 o'clock, it was a bit squeaky bum time to make sure we get things in and before the deadline. Karen Patterson, who's the football administrator here, was really working her magic. She had four transfers going at the one time, all with different clauses and different things going on. So she had a lot to deal with, but she handled it fantastically. We managed to get everything through that we wanted to, albeit we still missed out on a striker who we were after, but who knows, that might still come to pass.
I don't want to speak for both Jay and Buster, but I really believe that the transfers over the window have definitely boosted the mood around the club, and certainly the mood around the supporters. I don't want to be too critical, and certainly I'm well aware that we can't signal out individuals for our struggles, but the start of the season has been very disappointing, and there's been some poor performances, and dare I say that the standards that some of these guys set have dramatically dipped in the early part of the season. It must be hard for you to put your finger on what the reason is for that, but was it noticeable coming into the season after the European game that perhaps a few players had lost a bit of confidence in the spring from their step?
It's a good question, but I wouldn't say it was particularly noticeable. No, I think one of the key points, I suppose, of the summer was that to try and maintain things the same. And with the benefit of hindsight, this was probably the first summer in the last four or five if there's not been major upheaval at the club in terms of who's playing on the park. And maybe conversely, that's actually been, that upheaval and that change has kept things fresh, has kept things ticking over. Who knows? That's anyone's guess, I suppose. But as we said, at the point we were kind of planning for the European games, that we'd only really lost Sean Hutchison from the regular players. Obviously, James McFadden had left, but I think James has subsequently said publicly that he probably didn't reach the heights that he wanted to in his full year with Mullow. I think he played something like 18 or 19 games. So in terms of regular starters, he'd lost Hutchison. Obviously, then out of the blue, Henry Anier leaves. But again, if you take Henry Anier over the period, he had an explosive first 6 months of the season, but I think the second half was riddled with frustration, mostly because of injury. So, really, from regular starters, only Hutchison at that point had gone. Everything was geared in pre-season, and everything looked, from the surface anyway, as if it was fairly well-balanced, ready to go. I know a lot of fans, and I've read a lot of fans on Steelman Online or social media sites like Facebook and Twitter talking about pre-season and games. The interesting thing about this year as compared to last year was we've actually had more pre-season games this year than we did last year. I think the major difference was that because we were entering a competition earlier, Stuart felt that it would be better for the club if a lot of the games were closed door. It would give the opposition in Europe less of a chance to see us, less of a chance to try and put pick holes in what we do, I suppose. So a lot of them goes behind closed doors, and I suppose the downside of that is that supporters don't really, on the surface, and I totally understand where they're coming from, because obviously the club policy is that because of that we wouldn't report on the games. That there maybe wasn't a lot happened. It didn't look as if there was enough preparation going into the game against Stjarnan. So the Stjarnan game, I think, probably really hit us for six. Honest, I think that just really sets us off on a bad foot. If we could go back in time and win that game in Iceland 2-1, it'd be really interesting to see how the season would have transpired to now. Because I think not only did that dent confidence significantly, I also think the injuries that we picked up in that game. Because very few guys after that game against Stjarnan and the St Mirren game on the first game of the season trained very much. A number of guys carrying injuries from that game. over the pitch, 120 minutes on the really kind of old-fashioned style Astro. Really took its toll on knees and ankles and groins and things. Stevie Hamill, for example's injury that he's got now still relates to that day in Iceland. So that, I think that set the mood really for the season. Then all of a sudden, you know, you win against St Mirren, you don't play particularly well, but you get the 3 points, so, you know, happy days, good start. And then obviously we go on a bit of a bad run near the start of the season, and all of a sudden you get guys injured, you've been at a disappointing game in Europe, you then go out of the cup to Hamilton Accies, you lose the derby heavily at that point, you've lost a couple of games, and all of a sudden I think everybody, clearly seeing from everybody, even from myself, from supporters, that the confidence looked to have been completely draining out of guys. And for guys last year, they were taking the ball in, wanting to go on the ball, wanting to play, you know, wanting to create things for us. Guys who were trying to put in crosses, all of a sudden it wasn't happening. You know, defenders were hesitating before they're going to tackle, or hesitating to go in a header. You know, just all these different things. And I know it might be too simplistic just to blame confidence, just to blame form. I know that's an easy way out, but I suppose the combination of injuries, form, you know, a number of things go into it. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to put... There's no silver bullet, I suppose. There's no one rhyme or reason as to why it's not really worked out right. But I think, you know, from a hindsight point of view, you know, if you look back on the preparation and what we've done, I think most people are fairly satisfied that Lasley stayed, Ainsworth had stayed, Hamill is staying on, you know, McManus has stayed on and renewed his deal. Dan, you know, done really well. I think 5 out of 6 wins when he came in for on the loan last year, so he looked like a good acquisition. Obviously, Josh Law was more of a bit of a punt, you know, to see how that would go. He subsequently played a lot of games, but, you know, so, you know, everything pointed to something relatively positive, but sadly, a combination of factors, as we've said, kicked off a poor season. That kind of went, got worse and worse, obviously. You know, eventually Stuart McCall left, which was difficult. And then, you know, with the instability, I suppose, if you like, of the ownership thing really taking its time to go through. And then we are here where we are. You know, Ian Barraclough's come in. You know, we've started off well. We've been on a bad run, but as you've said in the opening gambit there, that hopefully there seems to be a bit of improvement over the last couple of weeks, and new faces coupled with guys coming back to injury, hopefully we're back on an upward cuff again.
Yeah, as someone that was relatively inexperienced in your role, it must have been very difficult, given you had a long working relationship with Stuart McCall in your previous role, and then initially in your early days as general manager. It must have been very difficult to see him leave the job when a lot of people thought he had more than enough about him to turn it around. It was one, I think, basically, it was a reason for starting out the podcast, because we were... It was difficult to know where you were as a Motherwell supporter when McCall left. It was... We all held a lot of affection towards him. We knew that results weren't going great. It's a fickle industry at times as well. You have supporters very much against the manager after a few bad results, which seemed incredibly unfair given his achievements at the club, possibly surpassing certainly any other manager that I've witnessed as in my lifetime at 28. So it must have been difficult seeing Stuart decide that the job had kind of... I don't know what he'd described it as saying, basically had outgrown the job almost. It was... taken the team as far as he possibly could.
Yeah, I think the kind of more terminology used, Andy, was that I think when managers and things are not going well for managers, I've learned that what they try and do in times of crisis is go into their bag of tricks, really try everything, change training, change formations, you know, do something different. And I think Stuart had admitted that he tried almost everything he could to halt the run of poor performances that he had. Obviously, a lot of his hands were tied in terms of injuries. Injuries were bad last year as well, but they tended to be almost when one was injured, with time they get back, somebody else would get injured, and that person could slot back in. So you actually look at the run injuries we had last year, we were quite fortunate, even though they had a lot of them, that they actually didn't really overlap with each other. A lot of we maintained pretty much for most of the season what was quite a strong start 11. I think from Stuart's point of view, he was quite unlucky with a number of the problems. Hamill been missing, I think, has been huge for most of the season for us. I don't think you can underplay how big a miss he's been. But in terms of the question, I personally was really disappointed when Stuart left. I felt he could have turned around. I really did. I think the board did as well. He was certainly under no pressure to resign. He was under no pressure to leave. There was certainly a confidence in him, and as you said, there was very much an allowance of the fact that he'd performed, you know, what was almost miracles. You take the four guys who are sitting going through this podcast at the minute, you know, even though we're all of us in our late 20s, early 30s, I don't think even us would be expecting Motherwell to be producing those sorts of finishes, those sorts of results. You know, guys who go older than us probably can remember getting relegated and playing in the first division. You know, but for the younger generation, I suppose it's become a bit of the norm. But, you know, Stuart performed incredibly well. You know, as I said, miracles is what the word I would use for it. But I think once you've got to that stage, and we were doing a youth cup game against Celtic at Morton, and we were going back up the road, and the two guys who were travelling with me, Stuart popped his head in the car and asked if they could go back on a team bus, and if he could speak to me. And as soon as he said that, I knew what he was going to say. He'd intimated to me actually after the Dundee game, if you remember. I think Dundee were 3 or 4-0 up, 3-0 up at the time. We pulled one back, or Yama pulled one back to make it 3-1, but he'd mentioned to me after the Dundee game that time that he was thinking about quitting. I'd said to him at that point after the game, before he went into the press, look, you know, don't make any decisions based on, you know, the emotions of after the game. Everybody's head up at that point. You know, you're often not thinking too clearly. Go away and sleep on it. Derek and I met him on the following Monday in the lead up to the Aberdeen game at Pittodrie, and he seemed to have cleared the cobwebs out of his head. He seemed to be really on board. He was excited about the Aberdeen game, what he thought he could do, how he thought he could do it. So that was fine. We thought everything was sorted, and obviously after the subsequent defeats at Pittodrie, then the real kick in the privates at St Johnstone. I don't know if any of you were at that game or watched it since, but that was one of the games where just almost everything that could have went against us did go against us, really, in terms of even the goals we conceded and the manner in which they were conceded. And, you know, I think Lionel Ainsworth had a great chance to make it 2-0, all of a sudden St Johnstone break and make it 1-1, and then I think was it Fraser Kerr wiped out Steve McManus to allow St Johnstone for a second goal. And I think at that point you could almost tell when I was speaking to him after the match that something wasn't right, so it didn't really come as much of a surprise, albeit it was still a frustration. But when he explained to me his mindset, which I explained earlier about his bag of tricks and trying everything that he could to try and do it, it became quite clear in the 45 minutes or so that it took us to drive from Greenock to Motherwell that I don't think at that point he could have continued. I think he made it clear that in his mind he'd almost became deflated with it. He became down on the duck because I think he felt such a responsibility too. He was the type of guy who took defeats probably harder than even most Motherwell supporters. I think some of the cup defeats that we all really have horrible memories of over the last 3 or 4 years, and probably the only blot on his achievements book, if you like. It used to really hit him hard, and it was difficult to pick him up at times. I remember after the Aberdeen cup game last season, where the Considine game where they get sent off, so down the dumps about it. It took him 3 or 4 days actually to come out of that slump. It was really, really bad, and same with Albion Rovers as well. So it just got to him. I think it just wore him down to the point where he'd been used to winning, been used to doing well, used to the team and success, 22 wins out of 38 last year. And when it goes the other way, it becomes quite difficult to really take that in, and it can be quite difficult to accept what's going on. So I think he felt at that particular time it was the best time to go. Obviously, from our point of view, afterwards, I think he handled himself fairly well. I think the email that he sent out to the supporters was great. It was a good touch from him. And he pens that himself, just for them, there might have been any doubt. You know, it comes to me and we talk through what he's going to say. But it's all from his own heart and his own mouth, his own fingers, if you like, when he's typing it. But the day he was leaving, the final day, he kind of said some nice things in his room. You know, it became quite emotional, you know. It became quite, it's almost like losing a long-lost friend or something. It's just one of those things that it's difficult to take in football because, you work with somebody every day and you invest so much emotion into it. And then when a guy's walking out for the last time, it's hard. It's hard to take because changing football's hard. You know, I'd been through a bit of, when I first started in my old job, you know, with Mark McGee for a couple of years, and then it was a couple of quick-fire managers with Jim Gannon and Craig Brown, and then obviously Stuart come in. But, you know, for over 50% of the time at the club, Stuart had been there. And, you know, as I said, you know, if he wasn't on the phone, he was next days, he was at games. You know, so you become really friendly with these guys. And you don't want to see them upset, you don't want to see them disappointed, you don't want to see them failing either. But I suppose when you shake hands and you go for the last time, you've just got to go on with it. And you know, obviously, it wasn't ideal what happened after that in terms of the ownership thing. But I think the club had no real option. I don't think it would have been right for the club. You know, some people online disagree with that, but I don't think it would have been right for the club to go and appoint a manager with the prospect of a new owner coming in. And you know, we had to wait, but I think eventually made that decision.
That moves us on pretty nicely to the appointment process of Ian Barraclough. That must have been pretty surreal for you, being involved so heavily, given your background as a punter and a fond player of Football Manager, as has been quite well documented in the press in the last couple of days. It was pretty exciting looking at all the names that were linked with the job. Quite a lot of people, and I must confess, including myself, were quite surprised with the appointment of Ian, given that it wasn't someone that was a favourite or even linked with the job in the early stages. He must have had a very impressive interview, given the calibre of candidates involved.
Yeah, he absolutely did. One thing I should tell you about managers, or sorry, selections for new managers at football clubs, it was amazing to me at the starting process who was claimed to be favourites and who was. I mean, some of the guys whose names were in the mix, you know, weren't even on our consideration list, didn't apply. And I think a lot of that's actually determined by either agents trying to boost a client's name or even how much money bookies are taking on people, you know. So although his name wasn't out at the start, his name was very much on the consideration list, sorry, right from the get-go. His CD was incredibly impressive, both in terms of how it looked and also in terms of the content that it had. I got a good feel for him right away when his application form came in. But you're right, there were I think in the end up about 84 applicants, of which about 15 to 20 were based on their Football Manager experience, which, as you said, you know, as much as I like Football Manager, I don't think, other than a team in Azerbaijan, I think it was, I don't think you'd be stuck down the road of appointing managers based on their Football Manager experience.
This is possibly a good chance for Buster to apologise for sending in that application.
I was going to say, you must have got mine under the fake name, aye?
I don't know whose name that was. There was one, in particular one. I don't know if it was you, Buster, but I've still got it actually sitting in front of me here. And I hope it is you, but I'm going to keep it.
Was it Billy Stark by any chance? Billy Stark? When I think the first couple of weeks we did the podcast, Billy Stark was like the far and away favourite to be Motherwell boss. And
yeah.
There didn't seem to be any chat behind that whatsoever.
None whatsoever. I think it was just, I tell you what that was, yeah, I think it was just a timing issue, isn't it, that we were looking for a manager, and I think Billy Stark had left the SFA at that point, so a lot of people put two and two together and got five, effectively, but no, Billy was never in the show. His name was on the list because somebody put his name forward, not him, I have to say, but somebody put his name forward, and at that point, we weren't really named off the list, the large list, if you like. He certainly never applied in person, but he... His name certainly didn't crop up when we cut the list down to the people, and that was not any reflection on Billy at all. It was just the direction that the club wanted to go in at that particular time. And you know, and that, as I said, that wasn't anything personal to him or any other person. It wasn't, you know, considered for a list. It was just purely what the club wanted to go down for. But no, there was one application form from Colin McAdam, aka Creepy Call by his own admission, and his. And his is brilliant, and I'm going to... I'll tell you what, I'd actually spoke to him, Colin, if that is a real person. I don't know if this is a pseudonym or made up, but I certainly spoke to him via Twitter, CreepyCall91, which is great. To be honest with you, he gave me his permission to publish it. I think it was one of those things that went quite viral, because it was really funny. But I decided not to do it, one, because I wasn't too sure whether or not the application was actually serious or not. I didn't want to... Didn't want to incriminate myself or another person by publishing a genuine application for the job. The other thing as well, because the club weren't doing particularly well at the time, I didn't think it would go down too well if we are seen to be joking about the applications that are really quite funny.
You also need to keep it just in case these new signings don't come off and you need to appoint Creepy Colin before the end of the season.
Indeed. I'm sure he'll forgive me for writing off the starting line as the old saying goes, better late than Nevin, which I... which started off the letter quite funnily. talks about, yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, you know, I'm sure if he's listening to this podcast and he wants us to put it out and he'll give him permission, I'll do it. But a part of his work experience, apparently his work experience was 120 hours community service, certainly in Motherwell, Scottish, Scotland, which I thought was quite interesting.
It certainly sounds like the best man for the job, and I think Ian Barraclough was possibly under a wee bit of threat at this moment in time, to be honest.
A completely unofficial volunteer at the Commonwealth Games helping tourists, I thought that was particularly interesting as well, but no.
I think this might be Colin O'Neill, to be honest with you.
Who knows, there's some great things there. Brilliant. O grades, home ec, religious education and woodwork, brilliant. But no, you know, there was loads of good candidates. Actually, when we got down to the final four or five, they all interviewed really, really well. One or two in particular very well, Ian being one. So obviously, Terry Butcher, we spoke to Terry. I mean, the names that we spoke to are out there in public, so I'm not going to be telling you any names that you don't know. So, you know, Terry, Rob Mascan, Mitchell van der Gag, Kenny Shields, and obviously Ian. You know, Mitchell was fantastic as well. And I've said this to the other people, van der Gag was, you know, a really strong candidate, done really, really well. Him and Ian actually very much neck and neck, I suppose, really, when it comes to the appointment. But I think, after the discussions with the board and after everything was weighed up, I think, you know, given both were, you know, promoting a very, very similar view of how the club should go over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, that Ian was seen, you know, because the fact he's from the UK and, you know, that perhaps maybe a safer pair of hands, I suppose, is the best way to term it, you know, between the two at that particular point. But not only that, he just had a vision when he came in. And he spoke with real passion, he spoke with drive and determination, but also, crucially, he really had a vision for the way he wanted to take the club, vision of the way he wanted to play, a vision for how he thought the standards of the club should be in terms of recruitment, in terms of fitness, in terms of everything you can imagine a football manager. He just came super prepared for the interview and really, I think, blew everybody away with his knowledge, with his contacts, with his background and his achievements as well. And don't forget, I know we in Scotland sneer at Ireland often, maybe rightly or wrongly, who knows, but this is a guy who took Sligo, who hadn't won the league in nearly 40 years, to a league championship. So he's won cups, he's won the Satana Cup. So, I mean, he's got a history of winning things, against the odds as well, you know, breaking the Dublin stranglehold in terms of Irish football. And as I said, I know a lot of people see Irish football as a lesser cousin, if you like, to Scottish football, but you know there's a real history of him winning, but also a history of the bigger picture that he created at Sligo. He put in a lot of the infrastructure at the football club, and I think that's what attracted to the board of the football club, who ultimately made the decision as to who should be appointed. And his enthusiasm, his willingness to build the club, his willingness to create infrastructure, but also just taking forward the vision that the club have over the next 4 to 5 years, will, you know, really matched us together, and it felt like a really good fit. Not only that as well, and I know it doesn't really matter in football management, but given some of the history, he really is a top guy, top bloke. And if anything, over the next couple of months and years, I hope it goes really well for him in that sense, because, you know, super guy, super committed to the job, really hard worker. I mean, he's in here first in the morning, and he literally, I didn't think anybody could leave late on midnight, but he's leaving here at 10 o'clock at night almost every day, working every hour God sends to try and make this football club successful. And I really hope it works out for him.
I'm just going to ask it, Flo, because people will be talking about it anyway, but how much did the financial side come in it between van der Gag and Barraclough, or had that even been thought about at that point?
It's a good, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I read that cheap appointment. I think people said that about me as well, which is fine. yeah, thick skin in football. But no, the fact of the matter is this, Buster, clear as day, no Dubai, no problems at all. The budget for the manager was set before we actually interviewed a candidate. So whether it was van der Gag or Van Hal, the money that we were prepared to pay was the same. You know, so Barraclough, Ian Barraclough would earn what van der Gag would have earned, what would anybody else would have earned. So we hadn't even got down to that element of it. So unfortunately, it's an easy assumption to make when people put names out there. You know, name A and name B, he might be worth that, he might be worth that. But for a lot of people in the public, you know, a lot of that second guessing, they don't know what people are offering you know, we didn't know at that particular point because the value of what we were going to be paying was the same anyway. So it really was a moot point. But I can understand, you know, when you're not kind of blessed with the full facts, how people can make that assumption. But it was wrong in this instance.
Kevin?
No, that's fine. That's exactly what I was asking for. Sorry, just so you could get a chance to put it out there.
Please, any questions, just jump in at any time, no problem.
Given your background and your knowledge of the press flow, how frustrating is it at times to see you on the message boards, social media, perhaps in this podcast as well, people drawing conclusions and you not being able to actually properly respond to that? Does that kind of grate on you, especially when times are a wee bit more difficult, like they've been for the duration of this season?
Yeah. God, Andy, you've known me well for a number of years, as have the other two guys. I mean, I try my best to be as honest as I can. I try, you know, I have Twitter, people ask me questions on Twitter, and I always try and say to my other supporters that I won't lie to them. I wouldn't expect to be lied to, you know, if I was sitting with you guys in the stand, and I try and take that forward. Often, and you'll know this as well, and just common sense, there are times as a limited company that you can't say, you can't often disclose what's going on at times. And, you know, in those instances, what I have said to people and responded to people was, look, you know, at this moment in time, I can't really say too much about that. But, you know, hopefully in the fullness of time, I can give, you know, fuller answers. But, yeah, of course it is. But you've also got to allow, Andy, you know, the job that I work, the job that we do here, a public-facing business, it's a bit like politics or anything else. There's going to be misconceptions. But I think people generally make assumptions based on the facts that they have. And that's not all the facts. So, from my point of view, when you're sitting on this side of the fence, if you like, you've got to allow for the fact that people can only base their opinions, base their judgments on what they see, taking everything at face value. And that goes for my appointment, it goes for the Embarra Club's appointment, or anything else within the football club. You know, I don't hold that against people for not knowing the full story, because at times we can't tell them the full story. Could we be better at telling the story? Absolutely, no doubt about it. I think, I don't want to use the term excuse, but one of the reasons why it's been difficult over the last 7 or 8 months, I suppose, for me, is because obviously before Mr. Hutchison came in, it became, you know, a lot of football clubs in this country, including Mullen, I don't make any ashamed to say it. You know, you get any, with everything that's been happening in Scottish football over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, whatever, maybe slightly less than that, a lot of football clubs just became about survival. It's about trying to keep your head above the water. It's about trying to make sure you get through the next day. And effectively, that's where Mullow had got to. And that's not just in the last 6 or 7 months. That's been almost since the Rangers implosion a couple of years ago. It's been very, very difficult for football clubs. Obviously, Mullow laid it out on the line back when Rangers were going through their problems as to the financial implications of taking a decision, or the potential financial implications. And that might be, you know, reduced gate attendances. It might be reduced sponsorship income centrally. And those things have happened, and to be fair, they've been slightly offset by the fact that we finished higher up the table, so they've not been as bad as it might well have been. But there's no doubt about it, the club have had to cut their cloth a little bit. They've had to, when they lose members of staff, they've had to not replace them. A good example, I suppose, is my old job. I see that constantly coming up on social media or streaming online about why I still do my old job. And the key... the number one answer to that really is money, and it's not money for me, it's money for the club. It was felt we had to try and maximise the best for Stuart to try and give him the best chance. We tried to bring in Oyama, which is out with budget, and I'll be honest with you, I made the decision to order to help try and finance that I would work two jobs and save that money and try and put that money back into the football staff. And whether that was the best thing to do at the time, it felt like it. It felt like the team needed a little boost. It felt the team needed another player. And I felt at that time that we could save a wee bit of money, and I could pitch that, and we would see how things went in the League Cup. We would see how things went in the Scottish Cup. And then hopefully we get things sorted. You know, it so transpires that it didn't go well in the League Cup, it didn't go well in the Scottish Cup, and here we are. But I think the good thing about Mr. Hutchison coming in will be that I think he's absolutely prepared to and has re-evaluated the full business. He has identified the fact that the club needs investment in areas, one of them being its communication area, its marketing area. So I think you'll see in the next couple of weeks some additional personnel with some proper, you know, responsibilities, an action plan with tasks to do about how the club you know, sells itself to its supporters, how it sells itself to the wider public. And that's been one of the, for me, the, one of the main positives about Les coming in is that he's identified that. He knows that we've cut ourselves almost beyond the bare bone, just trying to keep our heads above the water in the last 2 or 3 years. But in order to for the business to really start moving again, in order for the business plan that we've instigated to really start working, we're going to need some investment, and that's in a few areas of the business. So you'll probably read more about that in the upcoming weeks.
Can I just quickly ask, you mentioned Steelman Online there. Obviously, as the man who created WellTrustFC.net that then became Steelman Online, does it ever feel a bit like a Frankenstein's monster kind of thing, that the forum you created is now a bit of a hive for negativity at times, sometimes directed at yourself?
Well, I suppose there is the ultimate irony in that, I suppose, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
You create it to be shot down at. Look, see, at the end of the day, as I said to you earlier on, Jay, the fact of the matter is, we work at a football club. I work at a football club. It's a public-facing job. Again, going back to politicians, you've got to have a thick skin. You've got to do it. Don't mean it's not nice. It isn't nice. I read one guy saying I was too fat to get to the press box, which I actually don't mind that. That's one of the easier things to deal with. You can slag people by their look at how fat I am. It's much more difficult to read about how incompetent they think you are. That's a much more difficult pill to swallow. But no, I mean, you know, in terms of Steelman Online or WellTrust, I think actually, ironically again, enough, I think I set up the forums along yourself and Buster and a few others at the time to actually try and get away from the negativity we felt for Park Corner had became, that the team didn't really deserve the kind of the hostile treatment it was getting online, and we would try and focus it a wee bit, not quite happy-clappy, but we would try and focus in a little bit more reasoned way to support the team and try and take a little bit more of a pragmatic approach to it all. But the you know, I suppose that with popularity comes a diversity in opinion, and because of that, you can't stay Mr. Happy and positive all the time. But also, I don't want to patronise anybody sitting here or anybody who's going to be listening to this show to try and say that this season has been good and deserves, and nobody here deserves criticism. At the end of the day, we're sitting at the moment joint second bottom of the table. So you know, on paper, it doesn't read well. And if anybody works in football clubs, particularly ones who have been doing really well over recent years, you take all those circumstances into account, then, you know, as difficult as to read at times, as difficult as for my family to read at times, you've just got to have a thick skin and you've just got to go on with it. And again, go back to and try and almost educate yourself to know that a lot of these guys, I would rather have A for angry rather than A for apathy. You know, if guys are on there and they're moaning, they're complaining, I suppose in some ways it shows that they care. It's a much more dangerous thing for us if people don't go in there and they're not moaning, they're just slipping away from it and they're getting fed up with it. So for me, I don't mind anger. Hopefully we can redirect in the right way. Hopefully people can see that we're trying our best. Well, I'll make mistakes, the club will make mistakes, we'll all make mistakes, but if we do them, they'll be honest ones. And I suppose at the end of it, I and everybody else at the football club will be judged by my peers, which is you guys, which is the supporters, because effectively it's the supporters who effectively make decisions, be it on managers or anybody else at that particular point. But you know, I don't go into Steelman Online now as much as I did, I have to confess. I still go in now and again. I probably cheat a wee bit and go in when there's some good news, just to see what they're doing and try and deliberately avoid the negative stuff. But Twitter, I suppose, makes it a bit more difficult because people can get to you directly and speak to you directly. But I don't mind that because, you know, as I said, it gives me a chance to reply back to them in real time and get back to them in an honest way. And I try and do that. And I think most of the time when people come on to have a go, the fact that I'm prepared to respond to them and, you know, prepared to speak to them and try and give them a reason as to why we think what's happening is happening, most people, I think, take that, you know, at least at the very least, there's somebody trying to speak and chat them through them, you know.
We discussed the ownership issue and Les Hutchison taking over. Yep. Motherwell, you would have experienced it firsthand when you visited Barbados and what was possibly the most mismatched trip that has ever taken place, sending you out to the sun. Can you give us a brief insight in Les's vision and his goals for the club? It gave a fantastic interview for MFC TV last week. I think people kind of want to know, did we envisage yourself as a front runner in Scottish football? Is top six seen as a success? I think it's kind of hard to place ourselves at the situation we are at the moment, and we've got to deal with the now. But what goals has Les set for his tenure at Motherwell?
Yep. Well, you're right. He spoke, I thought, very well on the interview. I think he always speaks well. Any time I speak to him, or any time I, you know, email him or whatever it might be, any conversations we have, you can always tell he's, I mean, you don't get as successful as he's become, you know, and not have something about you in that sense. He's very clear in what he wants to achieve. His big vision, if you like, is about the football club, but it's also about the local community. It's about North Lanarkshire. It's about trying to give the area, which he feels has been, you know, very harshly treated by governments, by industry, and other factors, you know, has taken a series of blows, you know, in terms of Ravenscraig, in terms of Anderson Strathclyde, in terms of Mullow Bridge, you know, and I think he just feels that this is his opportunity to give back to the town where he feels he was grounded, and help him achieve the success that he's had. So I'm paraphrasing him, but he sees us as the one last bastion of North Lanarkshire, you know, kind of old industry, if you like, that old social cohesion. So he wants us to prosper, and he hopes by the football club prospering, not only can we give local people hope, but we can also perhaps, you know, instigate some commercial or, you know, activity, maybe some local businesses, and, you know, really kind of kicking the local area up the backside a little bit. In terms of his vision for the football club, I think what he won't do is, I don't think he'll be drawn into, I remember when Mr. Boyle, John Boyle, came in, I think it was all about the third force of Scottish football and being this and taking fans off Rangers and Celtic. I don't think he's going to make any of those grandiose promises at all. I think his first and foremost is that he sees this as a partnership between himself and the fans. He doesn't see this as him, you know, this white knight coming in and throwing about millions of pounds to do the club, because I think that's been proven at our club and others that this doesn't work. It's not sustainable. So I think what he will do is, I think he'll work in partnership with the supporters. I think he'll try and help the Welsh Society re-engage with the Mullow support. I think he'll try and help the society get more members and become more influential in the football club, which is great. I think he will try and make the club as sustainable as possible. He will try and ensure that the club can survive on its own 2 feet, that it budgets sensibly. And that comes, I think, with investing in infrastructure, as I said earlier on. Sometimes when you get into a business, you've got the first-tier investment, which is effectively buying the business. The second-tier investment is obviously evaluating everything that's on and seeing what areas needs investment. So it almost starts paying for itself on that side. And that's exactly what he's doing. I think what he'll do, I think his vision is to create a sustainable football club for eventually the fans to take over. That might be 3 years, maybe 4 years, but certainly the plan is to have it within 5 years. He wants us to be able to go back to, as I said, budgeting sensibly, make sure that we only spend what we can realistically generate. But he also wants to, not just that, doesn't mean a series of cutbacks. Effectively, that what it means is trying to drive up how you increase your own revenue base, and that might be through better cut runs, which is much more difficult to actually control. But probably the main one, one of the main drivers, I think, for increasing revenue is certainly through player trade. We've become pretty poor, really. I think we'd all concede that we've been pretty poor at trading players. The only way, if you look across the River Clyde at Hamilton Accies, you need only look up at Dundee United to see the success that they've had, and a real cohesive recruitment policy, a real cohesive sales policy where, you know, young talent are made sure that they are looked after, they're made sure they're tied down to longer contracts, and you can try and then at that point attach real value to them. And I thought one of the most interesting points of his interview, and him and I have subsequently spoke about this both at, you know, since that interview, and actually I suppose before that in Barbados, where we talked about how I was telling him how we were probably seen as an easy touch in terms of player sales, that we were always in a position where we had to sell. Therefore, we weren't in a seller's market, so teams can effectively come in and test the water, knowing that we weren't really in a position to say no. And I think that what that leads to, if you look at Dundee United, for example, they're in a position now, they're cash rich, they've got money in the bank. They've almost set a precedent with the players that they sell, that we need to, they can then demand a certain fee for our players, whereas at Motherwell, I think people know that we live close to the breadline, if you like. We're always in the cuff. So at any one particular point, we might need $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 just to get by, and that's effectively what's happened. You've seen it with Oyama, you've seen it with Anier, before that you've seen it with Reynolds, you've seen it with Murphy, you've even seen it with Hutchison, albeit the board decided at that time to reject that deal from Millwall. So the it's all there. That's not any criticism of the previous board, by the way. I mean, again, you almost become a victim of circumstance at that point. It's really easy, I suppose, to demand high top dollar for players when you've got the cash behind you to actually do it. It's much more difficult when you're actually in the trench at the time and you're really needing money and you're worrying about paying people a particular month. Uh-huh. And then somebody comes and offers you a couple of hundred grand, you know?
I heard an interesting interview with Ronnie McDonald at Aki's.
Yeah.
He was saying that with the deal with Stephen Hendry to West Ham, he wouldn't have settled for anything less than 3 million. It sounded like utter bluster, I must confess. I didn't know how much it was actually genuine, but he was saying that if a boy's not good enough at 16 to get into his first team squad, then they won't make it. And he went on, and there's certainly exceptions to that rule, of course there is, but it seemed like he had a very, very hard way of doing business that would guarantee, and you've seen it with even guys like Andrew, who certainly had scored plenty of goals in the Premiership this season, but certainly I wouldn't have valued him more than guys like Jamie Murphy. It is quite frustrating to watch.
Yeah,
he's
absolutely
doing business at such an inflated level compared to a lot of our talents that we've lost and have went on to do fairly well as well.
I think, I go back to Andy, that's because Hamilton and Dundee United, respectively, I suppose, are not in a sale, they're effectively in a sales market. Hamilton are financially secure, they've made a lot of good money from MacArthur and McCarthy and then subsequent selling fees, so they're in a point, and the budget sensibly for the crowd that they've got, they're actually, as much as it might be painful for Motherwell fans to hear it, they're actually one of the real models of success. I think they've done a great job in convincing their supporters, I think, that the long-term vision that they have for the football club, which is producing young players, which is staying sustainable, which is trying to get good value for the trades, which is always give youth, you know, the benefit of the doubt ahead of experience. And I think their fans have really bought into that, and I think because of that, and I may be wrong here, this is just from an outlooker's looking in, that they seem to have, that there's less pressure on them to do it, whereas when you're Motherwell and you've been in the Champions League in the last 3 or 4 years, you've been in Europe 6 of the last 7 years, you've had success, you've got to cup finals, it's much more difficult conversation with us as supporters to try and say to your fans, look guys, you know, finishing second bottom or staying in the league is the most important thing. It's not the most important thing. What's the most important is developing players, being sustainable, playing young guys at 16, 17. So I think that takes a whole load of time to get through. And what I will say is, you know, in terms of the personalities involved, Les is by no way, in fact, you'll have seen that by his interview, and I can testify for this, and anybody who's spoken to him around about the club can testify for this. He's by no means a shrinking violet. He is straight to the point. He's no grey areas. It's very black and white. He's a straight shooter. And I think anybody who tries to mess him about on transfers by giving short shrift, he will absolutely demand, if he feels there's value attached to a player, he will absolutely not sell them for any amount of money unless he's the money he thinks that we're due to get on that. Because obviously this is his investment as well, so he needs to get, his view is to get his money back. It's philanthropic, he said that before, there's no interest based on the payments. So he's not looking to make any money out of it, he's just looking to get his money back, which is absolutely fair enough. And really above board and really transparent. So we're in a position now, Andy, for the first time in, you know, years and years and years and years, where we've got a guy there who runs the club who is well off enough to actually say, do you know what? No, I'm not going to take that 100 grand. I'm not going to take that 200 grand. If you want player X or player Y, then you're going to have to come up with the real cash. And that's a position that Leanne, Derek Weir, Jimmy Mann, others have not been in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, because as I said, Mullow budget, you know, pretty close to the line. You know, we try and push it as hard as we can and try and get the best squad available on the pitch. And it basically means at times you're going to be, from a cash flow point of view, very tight. And that effectively, unfortunately, puts you in a position where if offers do come along, you're not really in a position to turn them down or certainly negotiate them to the sort of levels you've seen for Andrew or for, you know, Robertson or whoever these other guys who have been sold out of Scotland recently. The good news is, as I've said, I think that'll change. I think you'll see, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, you'll see some of our younger talent getting tied down to longer contracts. I think that'll be a signal of intent from Les and from the football club and the board. So there's real positives to take from the last couple of weeks in terms of ownership change.
I don't want to dwell too much in the past, but would you say that perhaps that the way we've budgeted and kind of the over-reliance on being best of the rest or third or fourth has been a bit of a hindrance to us? to a certain extent, we've not really been able to reap the rewards of that success because, dare I say, the budget perhaps dictated that that was necessary just to keep our heads above water?
I think it's a difficult one, Andy, because I suppose how do you measure success? I mean, if you're talking about third, second, I mean, that's a phenomenal return rate, you know, for a club like Motherwell. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just to kind of almost then to be... And sometimes I do think it has been almost rammed down the supporters' throat that during these fantastic times, there's still been a substantial loss being made during the phenomenal success.
I'll tell you why that is, Andy, in my view. There are two main ways for football clubs to make money, Andy, in Scottish football. One is player sales. The other one is cup runs. And as much as we've been fantastically successful in leagues, we have been poor, as I've said, at trading players, you know, with a couple hundred thousand euro each for Arne and a couple hundred thousand each for Yama. So not huge amounts there in player sales. Where we have been dire, dismal, is cups. You know, I know it's really simplistic to say this, and it's there's a really rude expression that I wouldn't say in a family podcast about your gran and your grandpa, but had we beat Albion Rovers, which, I mean, I don't know what measurable you could have thought on that. I mean, that season we lost, I think the working capital loss was around about £180,000 that year. That one game against Albion Rovers would have been the difference between making a profit and making a loss in that season. I mean, even this season, I mean, we wouldn't be anywhere near the type of trouble we've been in if you don't lose a goal in the last kick of the ball in Iceland. I know these are all, you know, dead easy for me to say that, but what I'm trying to highlight is the very, 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 very fine lines between success and failure from a financial view in terms of how Motherwell have been pitched over the last couple of years. I mean, there's such a fine line, literally minutes on the football park, you know, a goal here, there, or, you know, the penalty misses at Hamilton in the League Cup, or just little turning points how we do it. Was the budget too high? Or is the budget too high? Possibly for what we can guarantee to bring in. I think, again, with hindsight, with the boards looking at it differently now, possibly. But again, Mr. Hutchison's coming in. I think he there's been an agreement already before his time in place, and I think the club set this out in a fairly detailed financial statement around about May. That I think, again, which I should say before I go into that, I think a lot of people confuse our honesty with negativity, and I understand that sometimes when people see figures in the club saying, look, guys, this is where we are, this is where we could go if it goes wrong, you know, people see that as negative, and I understand that, I get that. I suppose the flip side of the coin is the club say nothing and sleepwalk into insolvency events, like has happened elsewhere, I suppose. So as we try to get that balance, but what the club set out to make is, the club tried to set out last May was to say that, you know, this is the last year that the club can sustain this level of spend. You know, they can't go any further than this. This is the last time you can do it. And I don't think that's likely to change, even though the ownership changed now.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't a dig at the kind of enjoying the success. But it's more sometimes I think when, especially kind of October, November time, when things were a bit rough, we were losing games weekly and the manager then left, and you're getting closer to the supposed Well Society deadline, and kind of communication was a wee bit poor. Jay especially has been quite outspoken in the situation with the Well Society, but what is really positive to hear is we've had Brian McCafferty on here, we've subsequently spoken to a few other people that have been very, very positive about the direction of the society, yourself being very positive about Les Hutchison. It's got to be taken as a positive, but I think you're right. Sometimes you can kind of try to cover yourself at times, and then that can come across as negative as well.
No, what I would say, Andy, is I know there's been a lot of criticism around the communication of the takeover. I suppose you've got to bear in mind that in any corporate takeover, there is very, very, very strict, you know, rules about what you can and can't say.
Yeah, absolutely.
The society, myself, others all sign confidentiality agreements, which there's nothing untoward in that. They're very, very, very common in corporate takeovers. You know, that it's a very regular occurrence, which it really does make it difficult. I remember I was at a Well Society meeting with Brian, and and it almost was like that guy from the Super Bowl, you know, the guy saying, I can't say anything about this, I don't want to say anything about that, I'm just here so I don't get fined. It was a wee bit like that. You just see, look, guys, I can't say anything about that, can't say anything about this. And it's really frustrating because Brian's a bit like me. He wants to give people information, you want to give people the full story, but sometimes you're restricted a little bit. But that's not in any way, shape or form to undermine Jay's point about communication. I've highlighted it before. The communication of the club can be much better. The communication of the Welsh Society absolutely can be much better. It would be worrying, I think, if you were all three of you guys and your listeners there were listening to me saying, no, everything's great, I don't know what you're talking about. It's, you know, you wake up and smell the coffee. You know, there's an acknowledgement that what we need to do needs to be better. But I think the good thing is now there's a real plan in place to improve it. There's real action points. There's a very detailed 100-page-plus business plan. The board have signed up on a part of that's an action plan with individual roles and responsibilities about who's doing what and what time frame. So, I mean, that sort of stuff is absolutely... When Les and I talked about this in Barbados, I mean, that was real music to my ears. And people might say, why has that not happened before? Why has that not happened over the last 3 or 4 years? And I go back to what I said before, that effectively businesses at times get into almost trench mode. You get into survival mode, and it's very difficult to plan because you don't know what tomorrow, the next day, is going to bring. But now that Les has came and lifted a lot of that pressure off us, has lifted the immediate threat from us, then it does allow people to, particularly an outsider who's looking at the business with a fresh pair of eyes, hasn't been embroiled in everything that's gone on over the last 3 or 4 years, and said, why do you do that? Why is he doing this? What's that? What's happening there? Why do we look at it like that? And it's really refreshing for me for somebody to come in and just say, do you know what? That's good, but you can change that. That's decent, but you know, we need to look at that. I think that's been really positive for me, and I hope that people will start to see a real marked difference over the next weeks and months in terms of how the club operate, both from a communications point of view, but also from just a day-to-day functionality point of view.
This is all really, really good stuff. What we're going to do is we've got quite a lot of submitted questions as well. We normally limit ourselves to half an hour. We're now at 57 minutes, so what we'll try and do is we'll try and do it reasonably quickly without kind of cutting quite a lot of the stuff. I think people are going to listen anyway, so fingers crossed as well.
What I'll do is I'll stop blathering on and I'll try and answer them slightly quicker and not talk nonsense.
Not at all. The one big issue that kind of came up last week, and I was really, really frustrated about it, I must confess, and I think, Jay, you were very much the same. TV scheduling.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've suffered... We're now going to Pittodrie for the second time on a Friday night. Game's been changed. Even the slight kind of complaint about the St Mirren game changing from the Tuesday to the Wednesday. People that try to plan ahead to go to these events, I couldn't see any reason why we'd been changed to the Wednesday night for television. Are we completely at the mercy of our broadcast providers to change the games? I know there has been a month and a half's notice, but it is frustrating for paying punters who, especially those that are paying, knowing fine well that games do change now and again for television, but you're paying your season ticket at the start of the season, and we've had a lot of games changed, perhaps victims of our own success, perhaps the fact that we're involved in a battle at the other side of the table been an issue this season, but I think you can possibly get my gist of...
Yeah, absolutely. And you may have read my kind of response to this, both when Aberdeen game moved the first time, and then subsequently when the information came out last week. An answer to your question, I suppose, the short answer to it is, do the club have any say on this? The answer is no. We are effectively told 30 minutes before the press are told and before the punters are told. So we get no say in it whatsoever. And that was one of my criticisms when I took to Twitter to talk about it and subsequently mentioned it in a Daily Record interview on Saturday. The fact of the matter is this for me. I don't think we have to have this debate about whether it's broadcasters and fans. I think we can really exist in a world where both of them actually work hand in hand. The problem now is, at least the perception of the problem now is, that it's right now it's all focused towards the broadcasters, that the fans are second-class citizens, that they'll dance to any tune that we play. And I think that's a very dangerous game, and I've been on record to say that's a very dangerous game, I think, to play. I think supporters now, you've seen with the success of the Commonwealth Games, with the success of Glasgow Warriors, with the increase in success of Greyhead Clan in ice hockey, the punters have got a bigger selection out there. And if football clubs, if football is a game, and this country keeps taking supporters for granted, then I think it'll be a all. I mean, football club in this country already has issues, but that'll be hugely damaging for me, in my point of view. And I've said this again publicly, I think we can get a much happier equilibrium between the wants and needs and the difficulties of broadcasters. Because, by the way, I brought up with them both individually and collectively, Sky and BT Sport, about Friday night games and how I view them and how I think they could be more localised to try and suit fans, particularly if it's an alternative to Sunday. But, you know, I'm also understanding of some of the logistical issues that they have, and it isn't all just as easy as 1, 2, 3. However, I think there needs to be a greater involvement with supporters in terms of how these games are picked. I think there needs to be a great involvement in terms of, you know, their views being sought on various fixtures, if that's possible. I just think that we need to, at the very, very least, be seen to be engaging with supporters to say that, guys, you are an equal partner in this, that you are hugely valuable, not only to individual football clubs like us, but as a league and as a game in general. And I think, unfortunately, in the clamour and the chase for broadcast money, which, by the way, is hugely important, massively important to this football club, if Mullow didn't have the current rate of financial income, unless we could restructure the business, you know, almost overnight, we would be looking at serious financial troubles. And again, I said that on the interview in the Daily Record. I think to be fair, Stuart Regan takes a lot of, you know, criticism about the Armageddon point. I think without wanting to speak for Stuart, I think the point he was making at that particular time was on the basis and the premise that the broadcasters walked out. They didn't, which was great because we need them. But what we also do need is supporters, both from a, you know, historical point of view, but also even just from a, I mean, football's about supporters. Football's about a game for people to come and watch, it's for enjoyment. And if you start making this really manufactured for people who watch it in 50-inch television screens, then I think you lose a lot of what's made football brilliant over the last 140 years. But, you know, it's difficult. But if everybody keeps saying, we can't do it, some broadcast money, then we'll never do it. My challenge to the people of the league, the people who run the league, the clubs individually, the clubs collectively, is let's sit down, let's push it, let's take it forward. Okay, we've not been in a really strong bargaining position over the last couple of years. You know, we are hugely appreciative for Sky and ESPN / BT for not walking out when they could have when the Rangers implosion happened. But, you know, that doesn't mean that we need to rest on our laurels. Let's try and take it forward. Let's try and get to a happier medium where supporters at least feel their value. That we try and get more uniform kickoff times. We try and get at least try and get some sort of locality, unless there's a real meaningful reason not to. You know, and let's try and work together. I think it can be done. If we say it can, it never will be. But football supporters and broadcasters can exist, can coexist in many leagues around the world. I don't see why it can't coexist in Scotland.
Kind of brings us on nicely as well. For me, our support has been fantastic, especially the section of the boys that have made a fantastic atmosphere and really brought a bit of colour to Fir Park and to away games as well. I don't want to roll out the 12th man stuff and everything else, but it certainly must be a boost to the players when they're running out and seeing a vocal and sizeable away support. And when you're going to go to Pittodrie and see perhaps 50 to 100 supporters, it will be a huge dent to their confidence, given they're battling. Sure. Then that brings me on nicely to the situation, particularly at St Mirren before Christmas time, and the treatment of a lot of fans. We went into great length about this on the podcast. It was simply outrageous. It was deplorable the way that our away supporters were treated at St Mirren Park. Not for the first time either. We were told that that was being dealt with internally between the two clubs. Have you got any update on that?
To be honest, Andy, and again, I'm not going to lie to you, not much. I think when the conversations will really start to happen is when we're due to go there again next time, which I think is, I don't know, it's quite, in fact, before the game, the next time the two games play, I think we're due to play them at home again. We'll probably play them inevitably in the bottom six. Unless we go on some sort of super run between now and the split. Touch wood. You're right. I seen firsthand what happened to Milne in the now infamous Kettling game. I've seen again what happened, and it seems, you know, I'm in a very precarious position here because it's very, I hate it when other people comment on what we do as a football club. So hence the reason why we always try and keep it between football clubs. But rest assured that, you know, that the club will actually make as much reference as possible to this investigation. I've got Alan Marshall constantly on the case with this other football clubs, you know, really fighting the corner for the boys. Not so much as in them, but we'll deal with that when it comes back round to it. But certainly at other football grounds, you know, for example, the drum gets banned, which is ludicrous when you just say it like that, isn't it? It's ridiculous. But, you know, I'm hugely supportive of them. You know, if it takes me to phone other chief executives, if it takes me to phone other chairman, I'll do that. I've done that already at football clubs. I think with Aberdeen at one particular point, they were going to do it, and, you know, we managed to get a change of viewpoint from them and got it allowed in. So, you know, we will continue to battle on. What I would say an overriding point is, again, going back to what I said in the previous answer, we can't just keep taking football for supporters for granted. We can't just keep allowing for fans to get treated in any way they want and expect people to continue to take it. I think a really good example of it, and you'll probably laugh when I say this, I don't know if you've seen Only Excuse during the new Hug Money. Jay's probably only just seen it 2 weeks ago and known what he's usually like in Hug Money. But, you know, I think it was poor. The whole show was poor, but I think the only really funny part in it that I found was the skit about stewards, and it was about the Commonwealth Games and the guy was welcoming everybody, how you doing, hope you have a good day. And his supervisor came up to him and said something along the lines of, what are you talking about? This is a football game. So he puts on his kind of luminous jacket and starts shouting and screaming at everybody and all that kind of stuff, which actually, I think, illustrated the point with an attempted humour, but actually really raises a serious point about the way football supporters are treated in this country. I think, again, we tried our best to lead by example at Mullow. I hope all three of you agree that, and I can't take any credit for this, this is purely Leanne Dempster, Leanne Montgomery, Alan Marshall over the last couple of years. I think the stewarding has improved at Mullow, probably still not perfect, but, you know, certainly a lot better than it was when I certainly sat with you guys over in the stand 10 years ago. But, you know, there's still much to be done in Scottish football, and, you know, if you keep giving guys excuses not to go by giving them poor experiences on match day, then eventually, I know a lot of people are already voting with their feet, but when you start to lose some of the diehards and some of the hardcore fans because they're fed up with how they're getting treated, they're fed up with the experience they're getting, you know, that's a real, real, you know, that's alarm bells should be going off everywhere about that. And truthful answer to your question, have we made much reference to St Mirren? There's been one or two emails back and forth, but we'll make a much bigger deal of it the next time we're due to go to St Mirren Park, which, you know, is most likely to be after a split.
Just on that point quickly, when it is about the stewarding, when you've got, obviously you said yourself that the stewarding at Fir Park's a lot better, and I think we'd all agree with that. But when it is, I mean, I've been in touch with St Mirren regarding both this incident and the Ketlin one. I also spoke to the police after the whole Ketlin incident, and the police chief inspector I spoke to, you know, said that their police officers are perfectly, and football grounds up and down Scotland are perfectly aware that, you know, that it's the stewards who, I think the quote was, light the paper and stand back. So when there's this sort of culture in Scottish football grounds where, you know, you've got the police are saying that, you know, some of the clubs are saying that, the fans are saying that, even Only an Excuse is saying that, you know, how do you combat that when they're just, if it is, you know, if clubs are just employing stewards who are then allowed to act however they see fit without any repercussions, you know, how do you combat that?
It's a difficult question. I can only really speak for how we've done it. And what we've done is Alan Marshall, who took over for Leanne Montgomery a good couple of years ago, you know, really come under pressure from Leanne Dempster at the time and more recently myself to ensure that the stewarding companies were playing ball to our tune and not the other way about, that it wasn't the tail wagging the dog, if you like. And effectively, I think that's what football clubs need to do. I mean, effectively, it's your game. You're paying them. You can tell them the parameters in which you want to work. But unfortunately, Jay, it needs to come from the top of football clubs, or it needs to come from the league. You know, they need to get involved at that particular point. We try and take a much more liberal view to how people are within football games. We try and, within our best, within the rules, to allow standing. We allow flags. We allow confetti. We allow all the things we're allowed and permissible to allow. We allow that in. But, you know, if other football clubs don't do it, all we can do as a football club, as Mullow Football Club can do, is try and speak to them, try and raise them. We can't force them into doing anything. Everybody, you know, wants to police games their own way. I suppose at that particular point, and I would never encourage people not to go to a football game, but I suppose it comes down to you as an individual, and if the club tries, and you know, both to lead by example at the football club, but also make serious representation at the pre-operations meeting on a Thursday before the game, but you're still getting the same problems over and over again, then I suppose that's going to be a decision that the individual supporters are going to have to make. And that's a really depressing state of affairs to be in, you know, when that sort of decision is going to have to be made. But, you know, it just seems strange to me, because, you know, I wouldn't ever speak out of St Mirren. I know these situations have been really unfortunate.
That kind of brings us on quite nicely as well, to fall in attendances and also pricing structure of Scottish football. I know that clubs are over the barrel given their financial predicament as well, but it's a bugbear for quite a lot of people going to, no disrespect to teams like Kilmarnock, Partick Thistle, and paying £22, £23, and that's not taking into account travel, taking your kids with you, food at the game, your programme. It's a very expensive game to follow. Motherwell have always been at the forefront of pricing initiatives, but I think maybe this season has been exemplified that there's other teams with different ideas and different approaches that have been fairly successful. You had the 10 pence initiative at Hamilton Accies a few weeks ago, the pay what you like initiative. 4 or 5 teams, I think, have now implemented that. Is this something that Motherwell are looking at, perhaps as a one-off, or are the kind of arms tied, so to speak, in terms of implementing things?
I think the bring a friend one, we'll start with that. I think, sorry, not bring a friend, the pay what you like, sorry. The pay what you like ones is interesting. I actually feel, and I spoke to John Devlin, who really kicked all this off at Albion Rovers, I think it's much more difficult, Andy, for top league clubs to do that, because top league clubs, I think, rely a lot more on their gate than some. I know this is going to sound strange, but actually rely a lot more on their gate than some of the teams in the very, very low reaches. When you get down to the very, very low reaches, I mean, you're only getting guys who maybe a couple hundred people there, so I mean, it's minimal at that particular point. You know, despite what a lot of people might think on Steamer Online and social media, the club do regularly, you know, financially review the business. Every single game's budgeted for. There's a forecasted set of accounts done right at the start of the year. There's a cash flow forecast. You know, and everything's plugged in at that particular point. So it's all very scientific, I suppose, if you like, at that point. The big issue you've got with things like with pay what you like is it becomes very, very difficult to really ascertain what you're likely to bring in and how that is going to impact on your cash flow. The problem you've got, I suppose, is, and a bit like this MP thing, is you've got to watch as well about the precedent you set for certain things.
Perhaps so, kind of devaluing your game a wee bit?
A wee bit of that. I think what I would rather do, and I've said this, I've been on record before, is that, you know, I'm not in a position here to, I know you mentioned some of the clubs here in terms of the price. I mean, I think Motherwell at £23 for away supporters is probably up there with one of the more expensive ones. So I'm not going to sit here and cast aspersions on other clubs. But what they do, I think we've just got to that value over a number of things that we can probably talk about, you know, a wee bit later. But what I would rather do is give people much more value for money. I'd much rather make the day more enjoyable. But, I mean, not charge any more for it. I think we're almost at the we've plateaued now. I don't think we can really start to think about making football more expensive. But I think what we can do is try and, you know, give people much more of a better day with it. I take inspiration from clubs like Allison. I take inspirations from clubs like Odense when we played them in Europe and see how they treat their fans on match days and what they put on for their fans and don't charge them to do it. I believe that's the future, as opposed to actually coming out or cutting your prices to 10 pence or paying what you like at that particular point. I would also like to see an extension of a couple of deals that we've done. I think the Flexi Ticket is a really great initiative that we do. I think that's a real potential winner for us. Craig Holmes, who I know both of you know really well, was the person who suggested it to me, and we took it on board. Unfortunately, it's kind of been lost in the whole sea of negativity at the kind of time that we've done it. You know, the team weren't doing well, the manager changed, uncertainty of ownership. It really has unfortunately been pushed a little bit on the back burner. We've perhaps not seen that as much as we would have liked. Again, probably the promotion of it could have been better given, but when you take all those things into circumstance, like we said there. The biggest thing for me as well, in terms of what you go and away supporters and how we charge, is you've seen the deal that we've done with Dundee United. Where supporters with their season ticket can get into Tannadice for you know, a much reduced price. I think for me, that's what I'm going to try and be looking at over the next month or two to try and see what other clubs with a view to 15-16 would want to be involved in that. In fact, we've actually got a meeting at Fir Hill next Monday with most of the SPFL clubs, and that's going to be very high on the agenda about how we can try and incorporate, if you like, an away season ticket into the current season ticket, and giving guys like you three who go to games regularly a much better chance of getting along in a more affordable manner, because but also retaining the real value of the season ticket for the home club. So it's best of both worlds. Hopefully we'll attract a bigger away crowd coming to Fir Park by getting into partnership with other clubs, but hopefully as well we'll also see, you know, not only a retention in our season ticket levels, which fell unfortunately by a couple of hundred from last year to this, but hopefully maybe a growth in that, because I think that'd be a real big selling point. If I could turn around to the three of you now and said, look, your season ticket next year is going to be the same price or £5 or £10 more, but you're going to get any 6 or 7 away grounds for £12 or £13 or whatever it might be. You know, I think for you, you can do the maths in your head. You're thinking, well, that's £10 every away game. That's an £80, £90, £100 saving I'm going to make there. All of a sudden, you know, it looks like a much better deal. So for me, that's a much better way to do it. I would much rather do it like that, because it encourages attendance at both home and away games, but also importantly encourages regular attendance, because I think what Mullow have been guilty of and other clubs have been guilty of over the years is just in these one-off initiatives that you give everybody free access to a game and then we don't know the contacts them again because the club's not set up with the infrastructure to collect the data that it's supposed to. You inevitably you give them poor games that you can't sell, or I say poor games but lower category games that you can't sell, and then wonder why we don't really see a lasting effect on that, because there's no follow-up, we're not giving them the best product at the best possible times, and it's too intermittent. It's one game, it's on, and then you're getting in for a couple of pounds, and then all of a sudden it's back up to £20, £22 next week. I mean, all these things don't matter. They're too scattergun. What we need is a longer-term strategy with all the clubs in the league where we all agree on there's a longer-term view here. We want fans to come to our home games through season tickets because we want that commitment at the doors from supporters, but we also want an increase in the away attendance, because for me, certainly at Fir Park, that's been the biggest hemorrhaging of supporters over any other of the three. Okay, the home support has taken a bit of a hit, particularly in maybe the last, you know, 6 or 7 months because of the way the team are performing. But if you look at generally attendances, I think you all three would agree that the biggest, real biggest cut in the fans going to games is what's coming through that Maxim Office Park South stand, where, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago when we were all watching games together from these stands, Hearts and Hibs, you might have got 2,000 fans here. I think last time Hibs brought a set of fans to the football club, the McManus 1-0 game, the header, I think it was 339. So that's a huge jump in a very short period of time. So again, we talk about alarm bells and we talk about what's really alerting people in Scottish football to problems. For me, that's a huge one. The real decimation of the away supporters at Scottish football grounds. And I think that goes back to your earlier point about how they're treated. It goes back to price. It goes back to a whole number of things. I don't think, again, there's just one silver bullet. I think it's a number of factors. But that is the two key areas that I think I would like to work on. Getting more people through season tickets, patching up again, hopefully with an away season ticket that we're working on and hopefully can get a club agreement, but also that subjective flexi ticket that, okay, won't give people the benefit of the away season ticket, but will give people the chance to choose their games, their finances and shift work and these types of things. So for me, that's, I think, the two directions that the club are going to go. I think Les is very keen to try and use again the introduction of a friend, if you like, or try and help, you know, have the Mull supporters work with other Mull supporters to try and get them into a game, but again, not just one-offs, but, you know, a whole series of links and how that can be worked together. So that's how he's got in his mind. He effectively sees us as having 2,500, 3,000 salesmen, if you like. You, Andy, you, Jay, you, Buster, you're all Mull daft. You all know people who have either been to games and don't go, you know people who have not been to games but, you know, effectively you like the club. It's about trying to engage you guys to come and help us get the people back in again, but that also takes a whole other factors that I talked about earlier. So yeah, we've got a couple of strands to go on that, but for me at this particular moment in time, I'm the periodic one-off, you know, little schemes to get people through the door and a one-off and then abandon it, you know, shortly after, I think are over.
Sorry, on you go, Buster. Excuse me.
Sorry, I was just going to say, how many tickets does the club give to, like, schools and, you know, like, being boys clubs, football teams and things like that? Because I remember one day last year, there was, I can't remember who the game was against, but there was a whole bunch of kids in the south stand.
Yeah.
And, you know, the well boys got involved with them. And you can see the boys next to them were getting right into it as well. You know what I mean? Thinking, you know, that's the sort of thing they need to be sort of, yeah. I know football supporters, you know, the language and things like, you know, I know all that, but that's the sort of thing they need to be getting involved with in order to bring them back as well when they are here, to get them hooked when they're younger. How many tickets roughly did they give away at any point?
About they give away about 600-700 a game. Not all of them are taken up, I have to say. But I think the key point, you're right, Buster, and the other game was Ross County, wasn't it? 2-0 home, McFadden scored. It was the last game of the season, and the South Stand was filled up. But again, I go back to the key point of that the whole issue is, see those people who come in there, Buster, we don't know who they are. Right now, I can tell you who any of them were. So there's no possibility for me now to go and say to them, guys, remember that game against Ross County? But it was a week later. Remember that last week? You were singing with the Well Boys, and it was great, and it was a great atmosphere. The team won, they done well. Come back to Mullow. Here's another voucher, come back. So we need to get much cuter and much better. And we're doing that, and again, this is going back to some of the stuff that Les has done through the business plan. There's investment there, possibly, to try and get this data a bit better, to try and get our infrastructure in here much, much more equipped to cope with that. So we can grow it, because, as I said, you know, I agree with you getting these guys in. I'm sure, you know, everyone is, will know, if not you yourself, Mullow fans who adopted the club, if you like, because of these schemes through their school or through their boys' club or their BBs or whatever it might be, and they're probably still coming 10, 15, 20 years later. We need to get that back involved, absolutely. We do a lot through North Lancashire Council. We don't do enough. We need to do more, but crucially, we need to be set up better here to take advantage of the people who do come through and making sure that they are actually getting communicated with, that they're feeling a part of the club, and it's not just a, here's a ticket, come along and we enjoy it, by the way, pay 20 quid to come in next week, because it's just not going to work. We've tried it, but John Boyle was trying it in 1998, and it wasn't working in terms of realistically, sustainably growing crowds. It's not going to work in 2015 either. It needs a much more broader, longer-term, information-based strategy. And again, going back to Les, we've talked about it, we've ironed it out, we've apportioned people, we've apportioned investment. That's what's going to happen, and hopefully, again, with the things that we're talking about with other football clubs, we can start to see a varied prong attack, both in our home support and our away support.
Thanks.
I'll finish just for myself. I think Jay and Buster both have questions as well. Hopefully not too many, or we're going to be here well into Tuesday morning. But there's been a lot of questions in what your role at the club entails, Alan, and if you read Steel Money Online, basically you do nothing, so you need to really up your game there a wee bit. But how much does your role as general manager differ from Leanne Dempster's role as chief executive? Is it that's been the kind of most prominent question that's been asked? And
I've seen that. It differs quite significantly. I'll tell you why. Fundamentally, a chief executive sits on a board and takes decisions on a board, and a general manager doesn't sit on a board and carries out the wishes of the board, would you like? And don't get me wrong, I'm not going to sit and patronise anybody here and say I don't have a relationship with Derek Weir or Jim McMahon or anybody else where I can have influence on the board. Of course I do. The big difference now is that the whole makeup of the club is massively different. The board now are far more engaged than even when I first started the job. Right now there are five subcommittees of the board, each with an own-headed person from the board who have got that responsibility, finance, football, commercial and marketing, etc., etc. So effectively I'm there to help them and oversee that and carry that out. So, my role is almost totally different to Leanne, because Leanne, when she was at Motherwell, and she'll not mind me saying this, had a very all-encompassing role. She got involved in massive amounts of things. Mine's is slightly different because there's much more responsibility apportioned to members of the board, and it's my job to work with them in the various different departments and help them oversee it and report back into them the results and how things are driven. So, my role's different in as far as that. Leanne a lot of times would dictate and execute policy. My role effectively is to work alongside the various appointed members of the board to the various subcommittees and report into them and give them an idea of what's going on and help driving them and the targets we've all set out through the business plan. So, you know, do I sit and question Diane about how much trackside balls she sold? Yeah. Do I work with Ian Barclough to help identify players and speak to agents? Yeah. But that's absolutely what you would expect. You know, I suppose the big question would be, what was my role different maybe 2 or 3 months ago when the current people weren't involved? And I would say it was fairly similar to Leanne. There were aspects of it that even when I first took the job that I said to the board before I took it, look, I'm going to need help on that. I'm going to need you to get tighter to the club on that. big one in Bid Finance, for example. We have got Derek Weir, former head of Barclays Bank UK and Ireland. You've got Jeremy Mann, one of the most respected accountants in Scotland, you know, really close to the club sitting there. We've got, a lot of people don't know as well, the club have got a full-time financial director who is a full-time qualified chartered accountant who sits and works all through the day. I think people sit there, I'm sitting there with my standard grade accounts exam, working, trying to work through Excel and trying to plan the club. It doesn't quite work like that. You know, there's two serious financial boards on the board, or was. There's even more now, because Leanne Thomas, Les's daughter, is also a qualified accountant. And as I said, we'll get Fiona Larnock, who's a full-time financial controller. So, I mean, you know, that's one of the areas of the club that I've said, you know, look, you know, that's an area that, you know, I work with and we'll get through it, but that's an area you need to come tighter with me as well. But, you know, there are various other aspects and things like that, but I'm kind of going on, for example, one of the criticisms I read when I first got appointed about, you know, the concerns that people had. And again, I go back to what I said earlier on. If you take my appointment as on face value, I can see why a number of people thought, you know, that's very left field, it's quite strange, it's, you know, a bit, whatever, I don't know. I don't mind that, because I know what I do in here, I know what the role I've had over the last 6 or 7 years. A good comms chief, as you know, Andy, you know, works very close to the board, gets a very good understanding of how the business runs, because they need to be able to project that out in cases of crisis or whatever it may be. So, you know, I have a very, and also Mullow's a very small team as well, so you get, you know, you almost become, you know, involved in the decision-making process anyway through just to follow numbers. So, yeah, I mean, the role is very different to Leanne now, hugely different, but challenging as well. But I think now I'm really, really excited about, you know, what's lying ahead. I don't want to sit here and I don't think you would want to sit me and give you a job description of what I do. And, you know, this is your key tasks and responsibilities, because that's a bit boring. But, you know, it involves many of the roles that Leanne did, but now reported to in a different way, because, as I said to you, the board now are made up of people who are actively involved almost on a day-to-day basis in the various departments of the football club. And it's my job to report into them what's going on, driving forward their actions with the various departments of the football club, be it commercial or community or ground safety or whatever it may be. And that's what I do on a day-to-day basis, as well as the club media, Joe.
I don't know if it's inappropriate to ask, and I would imagine, not wanting to speak for you, that it was very, very difficult initially, given there was a wee bit of backlash, that the season didn't start the way you perhaps anticipated. Are you enjoying your role, given that you had so much success in your press role before you took this position?
I have to say, I suppose what you can say is I've had a bit of a baptism of fire. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Conversely, I think that's often the best way to learn as well, Andy, that, you know, when you're pretty much thrown in at the deep end. When I say thrown in at the deep end, there's just a lot of things that have come up in my time here already in 6 or 7 months that you perhaps, if I had 5 or 6 years experience, might have been slightly easier for me to cope with and take, but I didn't, so I just need to go on with it. You know, in terms of the managerial changes, there have been a number of things that perhaps the club have kicked in the long grass over the last 5, 6 years that have kind of come home to roost a little bit in my 7 or 8 months. But I've just had to deal with it and go on with them in the best way that I can. There's a lot of things going on. Bear in mind, we had the first takeover bid. Not a lot of people know this, but we had the first takeover bid on June the 16th, I think it was. So literally I had 15 days in this job without actively a takeover element to the club. And that wasn't the current owner, and it wasn't the rival bid to the current owner. There was another one that actually didn't really get reported on and fell through the summer, which was taking up large amounts of my time and very stressful at the time. But I'm enjoying it. I tell you what, a bit like Stuart, I suppose, I take defeats, you know, very hard, because I suppose now I feel an added element of responsibility. I don't pick the team, obviously. I don't get involved in any of that side. No this football club ever would. And if anybody ever made me do it, I would resign on the spot, because it's not my place to tell a manager how to train or how to pick a team. You know, obviously there's feedback from the board, which I'll give them from time to time, but you know, the manager's side is the manager's side, so I have no influence on what's happened. Obviously, a lot of the budgets were set, you know, for this year prior to me being appointed, so I had no impact or no influence really on the budgets. I don't sit on the board anyway, so I wouldn't have been able to. But yeah, it's been difficult. There have been times it's been really difficult, times where I felt, you know, is this worth it? But there's other times, like, as you mentioned, the last couple of weeks, like when Ayama came back, I think it was really a huge boost. I think when they made a couple of, you know, wins under Ian at the start, I felt really good about it again. So it's been really up and down, swings and roundabouts. Like, almost like a kind of exploded version of a fan, I suppose. You guys will go through the same range of emotions as I do. I suppose I just feel a really more heightened sense of responsibility because I'm sitting here, you know, in front of the computer, you know, trying to help guide the club through what has been very difficult and choppy waters over the last couple of months. But I really do believe, you know, the biggest success is getting the Les Hutchinson's deal over the line. It took a lot of hard work. It took a lot of sacrifice from a lot of people like Derek Weir and Jim McMahon, Brian McCaffrey and others. You know, lots of hours, lots of late night meetings, lots of Sunday meetings, lots of, you know, huge amounts of time and effort, which admittedly has probably distracted away from the kind of day-to-day running of the club because, you know, it's about putting in business plans. It's about doing, I mean, I had three sets of due diligence to do for the three potential owners over the last 7 or 8 months as well. So, you know, that's all hugely time-consuming as well. It gives you good insight to the business, I suppose, but it's been hugely time-consuming and difficult. But I know the real relief now, I suppose, is that Les is now in here. He's evaluated everybody. I think I was probably on an interview, I suppose, when I was over in Barbados. I'm quite philosophical about it all now. You know, whatever's best for the football club, I'm happy to go with and happy to do. So I said to somebody on Twitter today, in the moment that I felt my position here was being having a detrimental impact on the football club, is the day I would walk out. And I make absolutely no bones about that. If I thought that I was hindering this football club, then I would walk out and not expect a penny for going either. So that still stands to this day. And, you know, hopefully that day never comes, but I'll just take one day, I think.
We'll wrap up with Jay's kind of in their scheduling, because we're actually very well prepared and very professional in this whole setup. Despite perceptions about us, Jay has got a question for you. And then, basically, just now, I would like to thank you for your time, Alan. It's very much appreciated and hopefully something that can perhaps become a regular occurrence. I know that the people that have submitted questions really appreciate you taking the time to answer them, and we do too. Yeah. So, thanks very much, mate.
No, I'm absolutely delighted to be here, delighted to talk to you. I wanted to wait until... you know, I said this to you a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to wait. There's actually some things I would like. I told you about that I'm still not quite over the line in terms of some of the changes I'm making to the club and in terms of sports science, in terms of strength and conditioning, in terms of scouting, in terms of analysis. There's loads of brilliant infrastructure stuff going on, but we're hoping, you know, you'll hopefully read about that on the soon-to-be relaunched new website as well, that's coming in the next couple of weeks as well. So, yeah, there's lots of positives going on.
Brilliant.
I was just going to ask, is obviously a lot of folk will be listening, and they'll be listening to, you know, Motherwell's general manager. I think to me and Buster in particular, we'll be listening to Flo, the guy who was integral in creating Well Trust FC. So to have went from that, you know, all the days out, like Stranraer away, Queen of the South away, even the odd, I'm sure you'll remember, Lithuania away with the Pineapple Tartan Army, and what was now almost 9 years ago, which is terrifying. It was just to basically find out if there's any one thing or a couple of things that you miss most about, you know, no longer being, for lack of a better phrase, you know, an ordinary supporter anymore.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and yeah, it is. I don't know, it's hard to put maybe exact answers. I remember those things you talked about, the great fondness, you know, particularly the trip to Lithuania, which was brilliant. I think the element of, I do miss the element of sport, and I suppose one of the things, Alan McDonald, the kit man, dare I say my future father-in-law, mentioned to me when I first started the club, this is one of the real downsides that he's found, because he's very much like me, the huge fan of the football club, massive fan. He said one of the real drawbacks and downsides of becoming an employee, if you like, is you see the club once and all. And I suppose when you're a supporter, I know it's intensified because of the internet and because of social media, there's a greater understanding of the football club. But certainly when I was growing up, the football club almost had this mythical plateau for me, that everything was magical about it, and the players are really mysterious because you only really seen them once a week and you haven't really heard from them at that particular point. But when you're in a football club, as I see, you see all the good points and all the bad points. So I suppose one of the things that I miss is just going to the game with you guys, enjoying it, using it as a release, because I used to use football for me as a time to get away from problems, a time I could go and let off some steam and just be with my friends. So, you know, from a social point, I miss that. I look at certain games where I really look over at the crowd and I'm sitting with shirt and tie on in the board in the director's box, or previously sitting in the director's box, in a press box. For example, over in Nonsea, I'm sitting behind a glass screen and there's 2,500 Millwall fans bouncing up and down, and me just thinking, God, I really want to be in there. I wish I was in there with my scarf and my strip and, you know, really enjoying it. But yeah, so it's been difficult at times, but I wouldn't change it, Jay. I really wouldn't. You know, it has been a wee bit of a strange rise. I remember reading a comment from you. I think it may have been on Facebook or somewhere, saying even you were finding it kind of hard to believe that somebody, you know, the guy who we were kicking about being having fun and playing football and shooting at referees in a Sunday league game, all of a sudden, you know, running the football club on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, I have to pinch myself at times. I'm quite a modest guy. I don't like to court a lot of publicity, which is maybe again one of the, going back to the previous questions about my role on a day-to-day basis. I think Leanne wouldn't be annoyed at me for saying that she was, you know, quite public facing. She done well in terms of speaking to supporters and done well to speaking to the press and the media. You know, I'm more of a guy who likes to kind of do things and just go on with them and try and do them. And maybe I need to take a bit of leaf out of that book in terms of communication, hence the reason why I'm doing this. But, I just miss the element of sitting with you guys and having a laugh and a joke, and because there's nothing beats it. But, you know, at the same time as well, you know, if you think back to the games at Aberdeen, you know, the European games we've been involved in, you know, some of the other fantastic events that, you know, I've been lucky enough to be writing the hat of, you know, it has its advantages as well.
Sound cheers. Well, you're always welcome to turn up at the East Stand.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if you've seen that Daily Record article. They made me actually go and sit in the bit that we used to sit in the East Stand over there. I don't know if you picked that up in the picture they put, but it was actually the same bureau that we used to sit on. So, actually, it's funny enough, I've encouraged some of the directors to go in and sit. It likes to sit down in Celtic Park, because I've been there, I know what it's like. I know, you know, I can't realistically and genuinely call myself a true unsupporter like you guys are now, because I've been so far away from that for so long now that, you know, it's difficult for people to lean on me and say, what's the supporters' view of this? Because, you know, effectively, by being in the role that I've been for the last 8 years, it changes you. It changes your viewpoint of the club and how things operate. But certainly, from a board's point of view, I think it is always helpful if guys, you know, go and sit with the crowds. And a good thing, I suppose, from our board is certainly the board, you know, that's outgoing. I'm sure you all read Andrew Wilson's piece. You know, you know Derek Weir's a big fan, you know Jim McMahon's a big fan, John Swinburne, Brian McCaffrey and Graham Barnstable to them. Just all guys, all Motherwell fans, and that's been a positive thing for us as well. But, you know, maybe I'll join you one day, put that sun cap on and my specs and my scarf over that I used to look at it. But right,
just to say as well, Flo, it's, you know, it was pretty obvious for the day I met you, you were very passionate about Motherwell. You obviously still are, and It's good to have somebody like yourself, obviously, at the heart of the club as well. You know, I mean, no doubt everybody else is probably just as passionate, but, you know, we all know you, so it's good to see you, you know, obviously enjoying it as well.
I know, and I appreciate you saying that. I think it's difficult because what you try not to do, Buster, is you try not to let emotion, you know, rule decisions, because that's the worst thing you can do at things. I think you can have an empathy. I think somebody's just been electrocuted there. So I think you have an empathy with the company, and you can, you know, you can really feel for it, and I do. And like you, I don't claim to be any, you know, more loving of Motherwell than you or Jay or Andy or anything like that. You know, we're all the same. We all bleed claret and amber. We're all here for the cause, and we all love it. We wouldn't be sitting on this podcast if we didn't. But, you know, I try my best now to try and take myself away from that a wee bit and try and make decisions based on what I think is best for the business, first and foremost, because that's what I'm paid to do. But I suppose it's always good to have that element of that heart attached to it as well. You know, and I'll always put myself forward. The club will always be number one. Me, every individual is always secondary to the football club. So that's the way I try and run it.
Well, to be honest, I'm expecting Michael Aspel to actually now tap you in the shoulder and give you the big red book. So it's getting quite emotional towards the end of this, isn't it?
Yeah, but no, hey, I take it as an honour that I'm here, Andy. I really do. I don't take it for granted. It's a huge responsibility on my task, but, you know, it's one I'm trying my best at, and hopefully over time with Les and Ian and some of the things we're trying to put down, I think everybody will flourish, be it me or anybody else.
No, as we say, we really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully things like the Since I Was Young fanzine publication and this podcast helps kind of bridge the gap between the club and the supporters as well.
Definitely, and that's one of the reasons why it's encouraging for me to see you guys doing this, the guys that do since I was young. Club media, as much as I've been involved in it so a lot, it can be a little bit one way, I suppose, so it's always good to get the fans into it, come in and try to respond directly to it. I'll continue to do that. As often as you want me on here, I can come on and speak or try and answer some questions. People can always get me through Twitter, they know where I am, and I'll try and answer them as best I can, I think. And I think, at the very least, the club have got its faults, but to be fair, there's no too many football clubs, I suppose, who'll put themselves on the line like we try and do, like I'll try and do. And that's just because I want to try and, make sure that, people get honesty, they get transparency. So, as much as I can come on and speak, as much as I can give you as much answers. Again, there may be times when I need to say, look, guys, sorry, I can't answer that at this particular time, but give me some time and I'll hopefully come back to you. I think people even appreciate that just somebody acknowledges the question and we can move forward.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thanks again, Alan. Next week, we're actually joined by Andrew Wilson, so our star-studded lineup continues. We're looking forward to that one. You've been listening to the By the Men MFC podcast. We'll be back next Monday. Ross County, which is a game that we've not really previewed, actually, but massive game on Saturday. Hopefully, all those that travel have a safe trip up and we return with 3 points. Until then, thank you and goodbye.